Here, this is tape 2, side 4. Tape 3, side 2. And Gabby Dinman is recording again. We're going to continue with our tape. Walter, I want to just get a few things straight.
Sure.
Your mother's name was Löwenberg.
That's correct.
Irene's name was Löwenthal.
That's right.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is.
Okay.
I was wrong.
All right, fine. That was a little confusing. You mentioned your friend who came to the United States, was in the hospital in St. Joseph, and then went back to Berlin and now owns the largest newspaper.
No, not quite. First of all, this took place in Springfield, Missouri.
Excuse me, I meant Springfield.
Not
sorry,
not
I apologize.
Secondly, the man doesn't own the paper. He is the senior editor of the largest newspaper in Germany, and also of I think the second largest publishing house. His name is Ernst Kramer.
Ernst?
Kramer, C-R-A-M-E-R.
Okay.
And he's been quite an important figure in post-war business and, I suppose, some German politics behind the scenes.
And what is the name of the paper, do you know?
I keep forgetting.
Okay. You mentioned that your mother had notes on Kristallnacht. How did you find out about that?
Well,
did she tell you about it?
She didn't have really notes. She dictated, probably sometime in the 1950s. And neither my brother nor I know exactly what prompted that. You know, we don't remember. We may have asked her, or somebody else may have asked her, to write down what she remembered about Kristallnacht. And I'll provide those. I did not bring them today. I should also mention that in preparation for emigration, as strange as it sounds, they tried to do things that would be useful here. So she took a course in learning how to make artificial flowers that you could use on clothing or so on. Because, you know, not knowing exactly what would happen once you arrived here. She never used that. And once we moved to Springfield, within a few years began teaching at the college.
German.
German, yes.
So you don't have any recollection of listening to the tape, or you just
No, there was no tape. This was typed.
She dictated it? Okay.
I don't think she dictated it. I think she sat typewriter and typed.
Okay.
Who would she dictate it to?
I don't know.
Now, in Springfield, I should also mention one other thing that might be of interest as we're talking about dictation. In this small congregation, there was no secretary, so I acted pretty well as my father's occasional secretary and got out a weekly postcard which told people what the service, the theme of the sermon was, and so on. But what was more interesting was that my father, as soon as he got to Springfield, decided that it would be useful for the people from Augsburg who had emigrated all over the world to stay in touch with each other, mainly as a mechanism for encouraging each other. You know, if somebody was successful in this place, then somebody else somewhere else would get the same sort of feeling. If he can do it, I can. So he started that, and by the middle of the war, probably sent out about 200 of these circular letters, maybe even more. I'm not sure of the numbers. These were, I guess they were in English, and they went all over the world to have a long address list. You know, India, various South American countries, the whole United States, of course, England, and I ended up doing a reasonable amount of that typing also. I still remember at the very end of the war, one person from Augsburg had survived Auschwitz and ended up in France and somehow discovered my late father's address and sent a very long description what had happened, how things had happened. And I still remember typing that. It must have been 10 pages, something like that, single space, which went out to all of these people. And the people that reacted very, first of all, they were grateful that somebody took the trouble to have them stay in touch with each other. And secondly, there's some funny overtones to this. When they were successful, for example, one person who probably was a big merchant in Augsburg became successful in Colombia, South America, as a manufacturer of combs, plastic combs. So one day in the mail, he got a big package of plastic combs. He wanted to show us, how well he had done. And that continued till about a year or two after the end of the war. And then people were well enough settled. That was then 5, 6 years, maybe 8 years away from Augsburg, that they didn't feel any great need to continue.
Walter, what prompted your dad to do this, and where did he get the list?
Well, he made up the list. What prompted him was a desire to continue to be in some way helpful. He got the list slowly. I mean, he knew some people, and he sent this to them, and he indicated, anybody else wants this? Have them write to me. And as things were awfully tight, he also asked them, if they could, to send an international mail coupon so that, you could pay the postage on this side. And then the synagogue didn't have a mimeograph machine for the weekly bulletin, that postcard. I did that on a sort of a hand mimeograph. So then he got one of the merchants in town to lend him a mimeograph.
And you cut the stencils?
Cut the stencils, painful proposition. The most useful thing I ever learned, probably ever, was how to type in the eighth grade.
That's a wonderful tool to have. Walter, you mentioned Mr. Spokovna.
Spokojny.
Okay, and he was the president of your congregation in Augsburg when you were there in 1985?
Correct.
All right, I'd like you to, if you can, take me regress all the way to when he became president, and also who the first president of the congregation was, and how quickly your old synagogue became activated with some of the Eastern Europeans that came back to Augsburg.
Okay. Well, after the end of the Second World War, Augsburg and even more the nearby suburb, I've forgotten which one, became a fairly important military base. And the little synagogue in Kriegsharbor, which survived, Kriegsharbor, was used by the military. And in fact, when I visited that in 1985, the base had been closed and it was no longer in use. And I went up to the Ark. The same thing happened to me there as happened to me once in a small congregation in Oakmulgee, Oklahoma. I opened the Ark and I became inundated with military prayer books, which had been stacked in there and now proceeded to fall. So that was an important military installation. And that meant that the town, which must have been heavily hit because they were big Messerschmitt aircraft factories nearby, began to be rebuilt rather quickly. A fair number of Eastern European Jews settled there. A good many in the early years were heavily involved in the black market. And my father's first contact with that community was really with a kind of a debate, you might say, which he helped to settle between the community outside and the new community. The people who had left said, look, we form the community of Augsburg even in exile. Therefore, we are entitled to the property of the synagogue, the old age home, the cemetery, and whatever else there was. There were a bunch of other things. My father said, that's ridiculous. I mean, we are all doing reasonably well wherever we are. We may not be prosperous, but we're doing all right. Let these people who are in the place now, who have absolutely nothing, have whatever there is, and use it or sell it for their own benefit. The community, after a while, settled down to a more normal existence, and was never very big. And so they used the apartment house and the school wing for a while as living quarters, and then used the small synagogue, about the size of our chapel here, seating about 100, for their services, figuring they don't need the big synagogue. When Spokojny became president, I have no idea. But he's been a Jewish leader for a long time, and so received this position of senator in Bavaria, which is sort of an honorary position. I don't think there's any real legislative.
And he's still president?
He's still president. It's probably one of these things where it's a limited democracy. And he himself is a manufacturer of bathing suits and bathing apparel. Has nice children, one of them studying in the United States. And so he comes over here occasionally too. And has done, you know, from absolutely nothing, has built things up very nicely.
Now, who built up the synagogue? I've been there. And who has the case? There were cases upstairs. Were there?
I think I went through that last time.
No.
What?
Nope.
That this was pieced together by Spokojny?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That one place for the organ.
Right,
the
yeah.
Yeah, that we knew, going to the church and getting the rent for 35 years. But I wanted to know who was it? All Spokojny then?
He was the driving force behind this.
Okay.
And then they decided that they did not need a women's gallery because there weren't enough people for that, and so they turned that section into a museum.
That's what I wanted to know. Who
guide you through it, and the lady who showed us around the Jewish sites of Augsburg was not Jewish and was simply interested. And the other party, who is very vigorous and who undoubtedly has been a lot of help, is the editor of the Augsburg paper, the Augsburg Allgemeine. It's lucky you're taking, well, you both know German. His name is Gernot Römer, and he has written three or four books on, first of all, on the Jews of Augsburg, secondly, on the Jews of the small towns in the neighborhood, and third, interestingly enough, the same theme that has now been covered to some extent by this man who has written on the Holocaust of the ordinary Germans, on the labor camp, which are really all pervasive, these mini concentration camps, which were everywhere. I saw the figures yesterday for Hessen in that book by, what's his name, Gold Hopper, I think.
The new book.
Yes, that there was roughly one for every area 5 by 7 square miles. So it's pretty well everywhere. So he, Gernot Römer, was also extremely helpful.
He is not a Jew.
He's not a Jew.
And his
first
name?
Pardon?
R-O-E-M-M-E-R.
What's his first name?
G-E-R-N-O-T. I think that's pretty, I'll double check that.
R?
O-E-M-E-R.
The 1985 dedication of the synagogue that you went to, that Rimi went to, could you tell me some of the people that came, the, from Germany, there were other people? It was quite an occasion, wasn't it?
A lot of people returned from, you know, from outside. There was nobody there. Well, there were lots of local dignitaries, of course, those kinds of individuals, as well as the people who are now constitute the community. They invited back whomever they could find and whoever was willing to come. Not everybody was willing to come. From the older generation and my generation. So there were lots of people there whom I suppose I should have recognized, but they had changed, and so had I, since 1939. And I knew them often from names on a mailing list, but not as people. And of course, a great many people had died. It was a very festive occasion with a meeting at the Rathaus and festive dinner and services. And we were treated royally and escorted. I mean, this was one of those occasions when we marched at noon from the synagogue to a place where we were going to have dinner. We went in a sort of, not a real group, just wandered down the streets. But you could see that the side streets were all patrolled. They just weren't taking any chances. There wasn't any danger. They weren't taking any chances. The same thing happened in 88, when I returned for the 50th anniversary of Kristallnacht. They had arranged a sort of a ecumenical service with all of the church people of that town and the neighboring towns participating. And then a big march right through the heart of the city as a commemoration in the evening.
How did that feel?
Well, you know, that was sad, it felt good to have so many people participate, so many church people participate. Just a silent march with the church bells ringing. What was interesting there was that at the synagogue was an invited list of guests because there were only, that has room for about 600-700 people, maybe a little more, 800 people now. At the Rathaus, where there was a public meeting, there were lots of people from the rest of the city. You know, this was a broad community, so it had some broader ramifications in that way.
Did you speak?
I spoke in the synagogue, yes. I spoke on both of them.
In all probability, you've told me that all that you know about that very small synagogue in the suburbs of Augsburg that was not, for some reason, attacked Kristallnacht. No, but you don't remember the name of that, do you?
It didn't have a name. It was just the synagogue of Pixhaven.
It was the okay, that we know. Okay.
Yeah. None of these synagogues, or I can't say none of them, if more than one synagogue existed in a city, it was usually named after the street. Or the district. So, you know, the great synagogue in Berlin is called Oranienburg. But that's just because it happens to be there. Nothing Jewish about that.
Because you mentioned that the exile, some of the people that were chased out of Augsburg ended up going to the synagogue.
Well, not that they were chased out. They went there after the main synagogue was burned because that's the only place we could have services.
So your father conducted services there?
No, he was in concentration camp. So they conducted services themselves.
So he never, when he came out of the concentration camp, okay, I lost the chronology. Sorry about that. I have the choice of asking you two things, and I think I'm going to, we have limited time, I'll let Gabi have the 16 generations of rabbis. And since you mentioned Gold Harbor's book, I'd like to know, Do you know the name of the book, the new book?
Something like The Holocaust in the Ordinary German.
Okay, and it's Gold Harbor, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
Okay, we'll check on that. What is your opinion of the book?
Well, you know, that doesn't have much to do with this. So,
I'd rather not to
I'll reserve
comment
that
on it, okay.
Because that's a long discussion in itself.
All right. You'd rather not comment on it?
Well,
at this point.
Not as part of this.
Okay.
I think so.
Walter, we know that you came from 16 generations of rabbis. Can you give us we almost need a family tree. Do you have that, or would
sure.
you like, or would you like us to record it now? Would you have all? You said last week that you didn't think you had all the dates in your head.
Oh, I don't have the. I have the names, and they are printed in a couple of different places, and I'll Xerox them for you for next time.
Okay,
that's
great.
Easy.
All right.
And you won't have a lot of spelling difficulties.
The German we can spell.
Yeah.
Okay, we really would like you to tell us more about high school, which would then be in Springfield. Is that correct, your high school experience?
Okay. In Springfield. Well, let me go back a little bit further in Springfield. When we arrived, settled there, and now I became, so to speak, a rabbi's child in a different sort of a setting, you know, an American setting. And I mentioned to you that I had to lecture on Germany, okay, which was, in retrospect, particularly funny.
Do you have any more to tell us about that?
No.
Okay.
And I started working in the summers when I was 13 and 14, I worked in a department store as a sort of an all-around helper, small department store, granted. Mainly unloading winter stock into stock rooms, which probably were over 100 degrees. It was funny. And the man, however, the owner, the Jewish owner, agreed that I could work during the week and not work on Shabbat.
And what did you earn?
I think 20 cents an hour or something like that.
Do you remember the name of the department store?
Yes, it was called Busy Bee. And the owner was a man who had come from Germany much earlier, 1934 or 35, and had settled in this town and established this little store, and did very well, and also was very interested in things Jewish. What was life like in that little town in the middle of the Second World War? We had no car, so we were very limited. Occasionally a friend would, with their limited gasoline, would take us out to the country. All of us liked the countryside. The countryside there is beautiful. So my friends and I, on weekends, would do a lot of hiking. And the town was small enough that you could walk to the edge of it from where we live in about a half hour, and then hike for the day. And there were a couple of places where you could stop a train, wave it down, and they would pick you up, and for a quarter or so, you'd get a ride back to town and walk back home again. So that part was very nice. School, I can't say I remember terribly much about school. School was not awfully difficult. Both of us, my brother and I, accelerated a grade, didn't feel any pressure in doing that. And went on through a junior high school and high school. There was only one high school in the city with three grades. 10, 11, and 12. Big school with about 1,800 students.
How many Jews?
How many Jews? Well,
in the school.
Yeah, I'll tell you how many Jews there were in my graduating class. There were two of us. And there were three other Jews in this that's it. And but I took off for all the Jewish holidays, and as my father was the rabbi not only of the Reform congregation but also of a small Orthodox congregation, which he eventually succeeded in merging into one, took off for 2 days for every holiday, wandered down to the Orthodox service, got acquainted with that too. The high school was good. There was it was really a good program, some excellent teachers, and made a reasonable number of friends. Interestingly enough, when I graduated, it's kind of funny, both the two Jews in the class ended up as commencement speakers.
Interesting. Well, at least they were fair that was permitted. I mean, if you were qualified, obviously you got
Oh, yeah, there was no problem. And as I was, I'd really finished the requirements for high school, except for one class. So I took my freshman year in college and my last year in high school together. College and high school happened to be across the street from each other.
You went to Drury, so?
Yes.
All right, now I'm going to back up and have you describe your bar mitzvah.
Well, you know, my bar mitzvah probably does not loom as large as it would for a lot of other folks, because I went to synagogue every week, taught in Sunday school as soon as I was 14, and it's probably the best way to learn is by teaching. And so, you know, it was very nice.
Did your father prepare you?
Oh, sure, my father prepared me. He prepared everybody else, too. This was a small town. And I was expected to do reasonably well, probably did. Not so sure. But travel was impossible. This was 1943. There was no family there except my parents and my brother. I think, as I mentioned, I got a heap of presents, shirts, belts, all that stuff, which I brought back as much as I could, traded off into books.
Can you tell me what books you were reading? Do you remember some of the books that you bought?
I don't remember. I do remember the first book that I read at length was a child, this was in German. I must
That's
have read
okay.
it many, many times. It was a child's version of the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Why?
No, it was a child's version. Yeah. It was not the Iliad and the Odyssey. But I can tell you the expectations at Bar Mitzvah for my father and for myself were very different. Because my father, on the occasion of his bar mitzvah, received from my grandfather, who was a biblical scholar, a Gesenius Hebrew grammar. And that's not just a Hebrew grammar. That is a highly technical, scholarly Hebrew grammar. And my father had no such expectations.
So what were his expectations of you?
I don't think he had any. He didn't verbalize any, you know, great expectations. He did not expect me to become a rabbi, and he discouraged me from becoming a rabbi.
And may I ask why he discouraged you?
Well, he said he pointed out the difficulties of the rabbi.
Such as?
Well, the frustration of not getting done what you really might want to do. Possibility of being in a small community as he was, where there was very little Jewish interest, where intellectually it was difficult, those kinds of things.
And what made you become a rabbi?
Well, I decided that this is really what I wanted to do anyway.
How old were you when you knew that?
I probably made up my mind finally in college, 16, 17.
So you went to college very early, I gather.
I was 16 when I started.
Was that difficult for you, being so young?
Not intellectually. Socially, it was difficult because it was funny. This was 1 year or 2 years after the end of the war. 1 year after the end of the war. So that meant that a great many of the students were former soldiers. They were 30. I was 16. They had seen the world and been around. And that also meant that a lot of nonsense which had existed on a campus life, a small private college campus, stopped. Fraternity life, they wouldn't put up with any hazing or anything like that. And so they changed that 100%.
What about girls and dating and socializing? I mean, when you're that young, is that a difficult situation?
Well, I socialized more with the high school crowd, and it took a while to really get into dating and partying. And there again, you know, these soldiers that had been all over the world had a very different view of almost everything.
So what percentage of the student body in your freshman year, like,
was military?
Yes.
Probably 60%.